Harper Audio presents Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success by Matthew Side, read by James Clamp. Part 1. The Talent Myth. Chapter 1. The Hidden Logic of Success. The Autobiographical Bias. In January 1995, I became the British number one table tennis player for the very first time, which I'm sure you'll agree is a heck of an achievement. At 24 years of age, I suddenly found myself on the receiving end of regular invitations to speak to school audiences about my rise to international glory, and would often take my gold medals along to dazzle the youngsters. Table tennis is a pretty big sport in the UK, with 2.4 million participants, 30,000 paid-up members of the governing body, thousands of teams, and serious riches for those who excel. But what made me special? What had marked me out for sporting greatness? I came up with a number of attributes. Speed, guile, gutsiness, mental strength, adaptability, agility, reflexes. Sometimes I'd marvel at the fact that I had these skills in such abundance that they were capable of elevating me, little me, beyond hundreds of thousands of others aspiring for that precious top spot. And all this was doubly amazing, considering I'd been born into a family in an ordinary suburb of an ordinary town in southeast England. There was no silver spoon. No advantages, no nepotism. Mine was a triumph of individuality. A personal odyssey of success. A triumph against the odds. This, of course, is the way that many who have reached the top in sport, or indeed any other field, choose to tell their stories. We live in a culture that encourages this kind of soaring individualism. Hollywood's full of such narratives, often sugar-coated in American dream sentimentality. But while these stories are inspirational, rousing, and compulsively entertaining, are they true? Here's my story in table tennis, retold with the bits that I chose to ignore the first time around, as they diminish the romance and the individuality of my triumph. 1. Table. In 1978, my parents, for a reason they're still unable to explain, neither of them play table tennis, decided to buy a table tennis table. A super deluxe 1000 with gold lettering, since you ask, and to put it in our large garage. I don't know the exact percentage, but you can imagine that there weren't many youngsters of my age in my hometown who possessed a full-size tournament specification table. Fewer still had a garage in which it could be housed full-time. This was my first bit of good fortune. 2. My brother. My second piece of good fortune was having an older brother named Andrew, who came to love table tennis as much as I. We'd play for hours in the garage after school, dueling, battling, testing each other's reflexes, experimenting with new spins, investigating new paddles, inviting friends over who, although more accomplished in other sports, were bemused to see just how far we'd advanced in table tennis. Without knowing it, we were blissfully accumulating thousands of hours of practice. 3. Peter Charters. Mr. Charters was a teacher at the local primary school, a tall man with a moustache, a twinkle in his eye, a disdain for conventional teaching methods, and a passion for sports that bordered on the fanatical. He was the coach of almost all the after-school sporting clubs, the manager of the school soccer team, the organiser of school sports day, custodian of the badminton equipment, and inventor of a game called bucketball, a kind of improvised basketball. But Charters cared about one thing above all. Table tennis. He was the nation's top coach and a senior figure in the English Table Tennis Association. The other sports were just a front, an opportunity to scout sporting talent wherever it emerged so he could focus it, ruthlessly and exclusively, upon table tennis. No child who passed through Aldrington School in Reading was not given a tryout by Charters. And such was his zeal, energy, and dedication to table tennis that anybody who showed potential was persuaded to take their skills forward at the local club, Omega. Charters invited me and my brother Andy to join Omega in 1980, at the very moment we were beginning to outgrow the garage.